I'm joined by Gaith Abdelahad, who's just returned from Aleppo. Gaith, you've been in and out of Syria a number of times now. Do you get a sense that jihadi fighters are increasing in number and influence there?
Yes. A few months ago, when you talk about the jihadis and you talk about the jihadi influence, people would say, oh, they are a tiny minority. No one have seen jihadis in Syria. Few months later, they emerge, and now they're a de facto on the ground. They're still a minority in terms of numbers, but they are a de facto. People talk about them as if they're talking about the FSA or any other fighting group.
Can you give us any sense of scale? What proportion of the rebel fighters they make up?
You know, many people say they make up, you know, around 10-15% of the whole fighting force of the FSA. But that's a huge thing. For example, in Aleppo, in a front line that had around 200-250 fighters, the jihadis made 40 of them were jihadis. Now, that's a specific front line in Aleppo. They exist also in Deir ez-Zor in the east, in the north, in Idlib, in other places. I do agree with the 10-15%, but 10-15% is a huge number.
I've seen it said that they represent fewer than 10%. Is it your impression that it's nearer 15?
Yes, I think, you know, since I last saw them, I think they've increased. There is something very important, Matt. When we talk about the jihadis in Iraq, when we talk about jihadis in Afghanistan or Somalia or Yemen, to be a jihadi, to be a foreign jihadi in say, Yemen or Iraq, it takes a lot of organization, a lot of logistics, money, connections to move, for example, from London to southern Yemen. In Syria, it's very easy. You just take a flight to Istanbul, then another flight to southern Turkey, and then you hop across the border. So that's why you have a big numbers of jihadis or foreign fighters in Syria, far more than you saw in Iraq and Yemen, in Somalia. It's very easy. They don't have to dodge intelligence services. They don't have to be on the run when they go and fight in Syria.
Why are they going? What motivates them?
The typical things, you know, jihad, fighting to support, the Sunnis fighting against an infidel army. But also, there are some of them who are, you know, just romantic international fighters, very much along the lines of the International Brigade in Spain in the 30s. You see some of them, like the Libyans. The Libyans are not jihadis. The Libyans are predominantly revolutionaries. They won a revolution, and they want to support their brothers in Syria to fight against the dictatorship. You have very few seculars who kind of, again, romantic seculars inspired by the concept of a revolution. But then you see the jihadis. And I want to emphasize something very important here. Not all the jihadis are Al-Qaeda who go into Syria, but Syria creates this environment that they can communicate, they can talk, they can train, they can work together. Al-Qaeda was created after decades of fighting in Afghanistan. And a similar thing, I fear, will happen after Syria. A new wave of Al-Qaeda or another kind of a jihadi organization will emerge after a year or two of fighting in Syria.
Do you get a sense from the rebels that this group is undermining their case with the international community and tarnishing the rebels' name?
Yes, totally. The rebels are very, very frustrated with the presence of the jihadis. They want to keep it very quiet. They don't want to talk about it. They refer to them as either the Turks or the brothers, the immigrants, or, you know, they say they are... they would basically try to deny their presence and existence until, you know, you have to see them. You have to talk to them, because they know that the presence of jihadis will discourage whatever, you know, international support they have. But at the same time, they're so desperate, those rebels. They need support from any form, from any shape, from anyone. So when the jihadis come with their money, with their technology, with their expertise, they have to accept them. They don't have a choice.
Did you get any sense that the the rebels were using the expertise of the jihadis.
Yes, there's a huge gap between the rebels and the jihadis. Those jihadis are veterans of so many wars against America, against Russia, against other nations. So, you know, the Chechens been fighting for 20 years, the Iraqis been fighting for a decade, Pakistanis, Afghans, and others. So they all have, you know, huge experience in urban warfare, in planting IEDs, in attacks, in organizing a battle in tiny streets. Versus the rebels who are, you know, still amateurish, still young in their fighting expertise. So there is this gap. On another level, there's an ideological gap. Most of the Syrian rebels are fighting for a democracy. They're fighting against Assad. Some of them are Islamists, but very few of them are jihadis. While the jihadis, of course, they're fighting for the Khilafah, the Islamic ideology. So there is a huge gap. The rebels are trying to use the expertise of the jihadis. The jihadis are there not for democracy, not for freedom, not for Arab Spring, or not for revolution. They are there for the same reasons why they were in Iraq or in Afghanistan or Pakistan, to build their utopia.
You quoted one Iraqi veteran saying that it was clear that the Syrian army was winning. Was that your impression?
I don't know if I agree with him, but I can understand his frustrations. He was standing there as a street corner. The rebels had predicted from the night before that the army would try to attack them from this soft corner. They kept talking about it. No one took any decision. And then this Iraqi jihadi just stood there, and he was very frustrated. He was telling them that in the battles he fought in Fallujah, in other places, they would plant IEDs, they would have sniper teams, they had RPGs. And he was very frustrated in the way that the Syrian rebels were conducting their battles. They would argue, they would discuss, they would take, in a way, they would take democracy and start running a battle very democratically. So everyone would argue, everyone would have an opinion, and everyone would like to contribute. And he was very frustrated with that. And he realized that the rebels would lose that very important sector of the city, which eventually they did lose.
But why were you sure that he wasn't right? How did it look to you? Who was winning, in your opinion?
Mate, this is a very, very difficult question. Sometimes I stand there, and I'm standing with a bunch of rebels. They're ill-equipped. They have, like two or three magazines, Kalashnikov magazines, between them. And there is a tank in the end of that street. And you wonder, why is not that tank, rolling down the street and taking over this whole area? I don't know the answer to that. Maybe the Syrian army is too weak. Maybe they've lost the nerves, maybe because they're conscript soldiers. They don't know why they should fight and push to the end of the street and get killed. But this is basically why the rebels have managed to resist for so long, basically, because the Syrian army doesn't have the guts to push towards the end of the alleyway and fight the rebels. While at the same time, the rebels cannot take over all of Aleppo because they're disorganized and they're ill-equipped. So you have this balance between the two forces, between the superior force of the Syrian army that their morals are, collapsing, and this ill-equipped force of the rebels who are ill-equipped, disorganized, but they have, they have high morals.
So the fear of sort of conscripts defecting is holding the regular army back.
Not only the fear of the conscript defecting, but which is a very, very important factor in this battle, but also most of the soldiers in the Syrian army are conscript soldiers, and we'd like to kind of portray the Syrian battle or the Syrian revolution as a sectarian war between Sunni rebellion and Alawite government forces. The reality, most of the soldiers are conscript soldiers. They are poor. They don't want to die in the end of that street. So this is why they could have taken Aleppo weeks ago, months ago, but they are unable because they lack the will to do so.
The Free Syrian Army at the weekend announced that they were going to move their headquarters from Turkey to inside Syria. Do you think that's going to make any difference?
Well, when we talk about the Free Syrian Army, which Free Syrian Army? There is nothing called one Free Syrian Army. We have different groups. We have different organizations. It's Mustafa Sheikh who claimed that he will move his headquarters to Aleppo to Syria. Mustafa Sheikh, one of the the commanders of the Free Syrian Army based in Turkey, but at the same time, he is in direct competition with Riyad al-Assad. He wants to discredit Riyad al-Assad by saying, look at Riyad al-Assad, he's living under the protection of the Turks, will I function inside Syria? So when we talk about the Free Syrian Army, it's a very generic name. For example, the rebels I met in Syria, they were so dismissive of all the leadership of the Free Syrian Army in Turkey. They didn't care about them. They didn't respect them. They had absolutely no respect towards either Riyad al-Assad or Mustafa Sheikh. For them, it's he who's there on the ground, he who commands the forces on the ground, can take their allegiance.
You made this documentary for PBS while there, and one of the things you've highlighted in there was an Assad loyalist being beaten by some of the rebels. How widespread is that kind of human rights abuse?
It's widespread. It's widespread. I was standing at a checkpoint which we're publishing a story about that eventually. I was standing with the rebels and I saw this man being interrogated. I managed to go with the rebels into the room where he was interrogated. And it was so funny, if I can use this word funny, but it was so strange. He was tortured in the same way that the Syrian regime would torture the rebels themselves. I could have closed my eyes and imagined I'm watching a YouTube of rebels being tortured. The same techniques, the same viciousness, the same anger, and that is widespread.
And there are no qualms about it, no discomfort among
commanders? Of course, there is a huge discomfort. One of the commanders I was with, he tried to prevent the rebels from torturing, beating up this guy, but he can't. Those guys themselves were tortured. Those guys have lost family members. They've seen their villages being bombed. They've seen their, friends getting killed. And so when they do this to the others, it's a sort of therapy, I think. I mean, it's horrible. It's outrageous. But I can't understand how the oppressed become an oppressor very quickly. There is something very important in this Battle of Aleppo. I've been covering wars for almost a decade now, Somalia, Afghanistan, Iraq. I've never seen vicious fighting like the one I saw in Aleppo. You meet someone in the morning, they die in the end of the day. People die very quickly. People get killed. When we say about, rebels standing in a street corner, a tank down there, those rebels would get killed to prevent the tank from driving up the corner. And half of them would die, and then the tank would roll into that street corner. Or half of them would die to destroy that tank. So they lack ammunition, they lack technology, they lack training, but they have people to sacrifice. And that's the horrible fact of the Syrian revolution, is it's ferocious. It's really, really scary.
We talked earlier this year about rebel infighting in Deir ez-Zor province. Did you see more of that?
There were some tensions happening between the seculars and the Islamists. Where I was, I didn't see any fighting, but I know that there's some clashes taking place in the outskirts of Aleppo, in Idlib province. You have open battles in the streets of Saraqib that happened between two factions of the Free Syrian Army. In Aleppo, where I was, the situation was so tense that they were unified against the advancing Syrian army.
And finally, how do you see it playing out over the next few months? It's going to go on and on?
I think it will go on and on until something happens within the Syrian army and they decide to stop fighting. I don't see the rebels mustering enough force, enough ammunition, enough power to take over Aleppo, let alone take over Damascus. Yet the regime is now living off this lifeline supported by the Iraqi government, the Syrian government. So once this lifeline stops, you see the Syrian regime crumbling.
Okay, Gaith, I look forward to reading your next piece. Thanks.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you very much.